not live, but for my Ken or yours, it's The Other Animals for Friday, September 18th. I'm Laurent Levy, glad you could spend some time with us this week. And what a week, huh? We have fires pretty much burning down the west coast of the United States. Got another hurricane in the Gulf that dumped about 35 inches of rain in parts of Florida. And, of course, we're coming up on 200,000 of our fellow citizens dead from COVID. There doesn't seem to be much disagreement that 2020 has been a pretty rotten year. 5780 hasn't been much better for those who happen to follow the Jewish calendar, but as you'll hear in just a bit, 5781 is just around the corner. With it, like we were talking about last week, eternal optimism in the belief that things couldn't possibly get any worse. I was thinking about that sense of optimism in our conversation last week with Dr. Picard. You may remember we were talking about when our dogs and cats start limping, and the problem of them making it even worse the instant they start feeling better, running around the house again, not giving the healing process a proper chance to complete. And we didn't even get around to talking about some of the amazing prosthetics now available for pretty much all animals, from dogs to elephants, even sharks. If you've ever seen any of the YouTube or Dodo videos of these lucky critters, what has to jump out at you is their complete lack of inhibition or feeling sorry for themselves. Doggy wheelchair? No problem. A new leg for Moshe, the elephant who lost her leg in a landmine explosion? Just keep those adjustments coming. They don't seem to care what the other dogs or elephants will think of them. And in fact, usually the other dogs and elephants don't seem to care that much either. And in lots of cases are more than happy to help with their mobility-challenged friends. There's lots of research out there challenging animal ethicists that tries to make the case that animals can't be sentient because they aren't aware of their own mortality. And I guess they'd extrapolate that lack of awareness to an inability to feel dread for tomorrow, that they only live for the moment. Well, whether or not 5781 or 2021 turns out to be better or worse than what came before, I'd like to think that their appreciation of the moment is a little lesson we can learn from the other animals. All right, we have a neat show on tap for today. In just a moment, Sarah Eifler from Jewish Veg is going to talk about some of the animal implications of the new year, including the curious case of honey. And we're going to conclude our conversation we started last week with Corey Wren about animal rights organizations and her curious theory on Trump veganism. And a bit later, Dr. Tom Picard is going to help us out with why our dogs and cats are itching so much this time of year. But before any of that, it's time for Animals in the News. Well, I'm sure by now you've heard the earth-shattering and devastating news that not only Miley Cyrus, but Mike Tyson have renounced their vegan ways, sending shockwaves to pretty much no one. Cyrus's explanation was that abstinence from animal products had left her brain unable to function properly. And Tyson said that without animal products, he would be unable to achieve what he wanted his body to look like. That, of course, was all before discussing if the hunter could kill a bison for him. Now, both of these announcements took place on a podcast hosted by mixed martial arts athlete and comedian Joe Rogan. Now, I can't say that I've ever heard Mr. Rogan's podcast or really know who he is, but from what I've been able to gather, he seems to view veganism as delightfully controversial, or maybe he's just responding to his show's primary sponsor, the meat industry. In any case, what I think is significant about the Miley and Mike show, yeah, try and get that picture out of your head, is that plant-based consumerism has apparently reached a critical mass that now has the meat industry's attention. It's no longer a mosquito bite. The giant appears to have awoken. All right, another story here. This week, Chicago-based vegan brand Upton's Naturals, together with trade group Plant-Based Food Associations, PBFA, and the Institute for Justice, IJ, filed a federal lawsuit against the state of Oklahoma to challenge the constitutionality of the Oklahoma Meat Consumer Protection Act. A lot of acronyms today. OMCPA, which goes into effect on November 1st this year. Drafted by Oklahoma Cattlemen's Association and introduced in the state legislature by cattle rancher Tony Hessenbeck, the legislation requires companies who sell plant-based meat products in the state to display qualifiers such as vegan and plant-based on their packaging in the same type and prominence as the name of the product. To comply with OMCPA, companies such as Upton's would have to invest significant funds to repackage the products they sell in Oklahoma. The lawsuit was filed on the grounds that such a requirement violates corporate First Amendment free speech rights and is akin to forcing vegan products to be labeled with oversized disclaimers previously reserved for the tobacco and alcohol industries. Oklahoma is treating safe and healthy plant-based meat alternatives like they are cigarettes, IJ attorney Milan Emam said. This new law won't tell consumers anything they don't already know, but it will have a devastating effect on vegan and vegetarian food companies, since their perfectly honest and understandable labels will now be illegal in Oklahoma. This law, which was first passed to prevent competition with the meat industry, clearly violates the First Amendment, end quote. It's kind of an interesting take on it. I would think, why would to equate the labeling with that of cigarettes and alcohol? There must be more behind that. It seems like why I would be out there saying, great, it's vegan, it's plant-based, but there must be something to the way they're describing that the labeling has to take place, that it should be alarming or. All right, that's our news for today. When we come back, we're going to chat with Sarah Eifler from Jewish Veg about animals and the upcoming high holidays. We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Olivia Munn with my shelter pets, Frankie and Chance. Say hi, guys. When I adopted them, I discovered that they both have incredible personalities. Chance's sole purpose in life is to love and to be loved. Frankie is a little bit of a scoundrel and always entertaining. They're a little bit of a lot of things, but they're all pure love. Adopt pure love at theshelterpetproject.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council, the Humane Society of the United States, and Maddie's Fund.
Pomegranate. It has reddish, leathery skin.
Pomegranates. What could that possibly be about?
Well, it's that time of year again, and of course, I'm talking about the high holidays. And like most holidays, Jewish or otherwise, the food tradition plays a central role. As you might know, one of Rosh Hashanah's oldest traditions consists of dipping apple in honey as a symbol of a sweet and healthy new year. Ah, but what about that honey for animal lovers? Well, here to help us out with that sticky question is our frequent contributor, Sarah Eifler. She's the program director of Jewish Veg. Sarah, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, enlighten us here. So did I get that right? So first of all, that the tradition of apples and honey is, of course, for the sweet and healthy New Year's. This goes back further than that, doesn't it? There's a little more to it than that?
It's one of many food traditions. So Rosh Hashanah, unlike something like Passover that has a very strict and specific ordered night and meal that you do with specific foods, Rosh Hashanah doesn't have quite the same thing. But it does have a bunch of symbolic Jewish foods that go with it. And one of them is apples dipped in honey. And apples have become really popular for three reasons. One, they're very abundant, especially in Europe, which is where Ashkenazi Jews were for a very long time. And abundance is something that you want to bring with you into a new year. So symbolically, the apple represents that. Two, it's sweet. And we want a sweet new year. We say to each other, Shana Tova Umatuka, a good and sweet new year. So the sweetness of the apple is one of the reasons it's popular. And three, it's round. And so the symbolism of the roundness of the apple is that we are in a cycle of creation. Judaism, and especially if we get into Kabbalah, which is Jewish mysticism, sees a year as not being this linear progression, one to the next, but as part of an ongoing cycle and a continuous cycle of creation that is always happening within us. Okay. So the apple represents all of those different symbolisms, as well as being easy to find and relatively low cost.
Mm-hmm. So then we get to the honey, Right. So the honey is the sweet. And for those who, honey tends to be, you know, one of these deals where if you are new to the whole animal ethos or the concept of vegetarianism or veganism, and someone who's never been exposed to this and finds out that someone who calls himself a vegan won't eat honey, it elicits this response of rolling the eyes, like, oh my God, you're so extreme, like you won't even eat honey, what's next? Well, it's not quite that easy, is it? What are the problems with honey? How is honey made, and what are you know, we know it comes from bees, but you know, we don't really know what the actual specifics are. So what are the from a vegan point of view, what's the problem with honey?
You know, I think honey is a great kind of symbol of the way that we don't think about how we use animals in our society. There's a myth that people truly believe and have never really thought about, that bees don't use their honey, that it's something that's free to take. And it's not true. It's not true. Bees make honey for their own use. And so the fact that that is a myth at all speaks to how much people want that to be true. They want to not be exploiting animals or taking things from animals. And yet, if you look into it, not only do bees use honey for their own purposes, when honey is taken from a bee's nest by beekeepers, what they have to do is they smoke the hives. And that is in order to drive the bees away and calm them down so that the beekeepers don't get stung. Well, what happens is that the smoke is dangerous for the bees. A lot of those bees die in the process of collecting the honey. And so there really is no way to safely and kindly and non-exploitatively take honey from creatures who make it for their own purposes. And so go ahead.
I was going to say, I actually saw one version of it that actually refers to that process as thievery. That in fact, that the lifting of the bees, lifting of the honey from bees, is flat out stealing it from them. You don't want to use the slave labor, but they work, and as you said, to produce this thing for themselves, and then the beekeepers steal. What do the bees do with honey? What is their purpose? It goes beyond just feeding the baby bees, right? It's multi-purpose for them.
Right. They also use it for construction in making their hives. I have to tell you, I actually, I don't look too much into bees because I am afraid of bees, but even so, I respect their right to their own processes and their own lives. And for that reason, I don't feel it's appropriate for us to use honey. And especially one thing I really want to mention here, this tradition of dipping apples in honey. The honey is there because of a phrase in the Torah, which is a land of milk and honey, referring to the land of Canaan. Mm-hmm. The honey that is talked about in the Torah, in the Bible, is not honey made from bees. It's honey made from dates.
From what? From dates.
From dates. Oh, yes. From the fruit, dates. So it's something called Ceylon, and you can find it in Middle Eastern markets. You can find it in Israel. You can find it throughout the Middle East. And it's a syrup that's made from dates. And when the Torah uses the term davash, which means honey, they're talking about date honey. It's actually, dates are one of the seven sacred species of the land of Israel. And those species are all plants. And they're enumerated as this example, basically, that God gives to the people to tell them what an abundant and rich land they're coming into. So to change that into bee honey is actually taking away some of the significance of what that land of milk and honey means. And I'll also speak a little bit to the milk, which is about, again, fertility and abundance. It's not about, you know, going to the grocery store and buying a gallon of cow's milk from an animal in a factory farm. It's about the fertility of the land and about the way that human bodies are going to be supported by the land.
Was the original tradition dipping apples in date honey?
So that I don't know.
It seems like a plausible. It surely was, right?
It does. The switch from date honey to bee honey happened in Europe. So it's likely that because, especially the fruit of the apple is much more common in Europe than it is in the Middle East. So that fruit in particular, and that apples and honey, is more likely a European tradition of origin. Uh-huh. Right, Ashkenazic. But in in the Middle East and Sephardic and Mizrahi communities, the pomegranate or the fig are more often the fruits that are used. And there's also, by the way, there's another of the food traditions for Rosh Hashanah is something called Pri Hadash, which is a new fruit. So you eat a new fruit on Rosh Hashanah, one that you haven't eaten in the past year, to symbolize sweetness and also this newness, and you're coming into a new level of self, into a new year. So instead of doing apples and honey, doing something like a pomegranate and date syrup would actually be very symbolic in terms of going into Rosh Hashanah.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Whenever we presumably challenge a tradition, right, it comes across like, oh, you're trying to change something. You're trying to change mm-hmm. something that has been around for centuries. And yet, this is actually more restorative. It's going back to the roots, right? But that middle ground seems to get lost in storytelling in antiquity. And I mean, that's actually what your organization's all about, isn't it?
It's like, exactly.
Like, no, the actual, you know, this intermediate thing that we're in here with using animals for these purposes is not the origin of the tradition. The origin of the tradition was actually much more, aware.
Right. I mean, originally, according to the Torah, we were created vegan. Every place that the Torah and the Talmud and all of our tradition talks about this kind of idealized world, which is the Garden of Eden, Gan Eden, it's a vegan world. And we know from everything that our Torah, our tradition, our teachings tell us that is considered the highest way of living and the most attuned to our values. What happened in Judaism in particular is that we entered a diaspora, and a lot of those original traditions that relied on things like the seven sacred species and all those abundant plant foods that were growing in that land, we were no longer in that land. And we find ourselves in Europe, and Europe in particular, because especially in the United States, we tend to be very Ashkenormative. And this is kind of how things like matzo ball soup and gefilte fish and foods like that have become so prominent as Jewish foods, because of Ashkenormativity. And the reason that those are Ashkenormative is because in Europe, in those times, we were living in ghettos, we were living in shtetls, we didn't have money, we didn't have these farms or land for ourselves. And so we found ourselves only eating things like schmaltz, like the cheapest, easiest to find foods that nobody else wanted. That's how we ended up with gefilte fish. It wasn't like, this is a great example of how Jews should live in the world. It was poverty food. Mm-hmm. And that's not where we started from. It's not our original tradition, and it's not where we want to be. That's not a true Jewish food ethic. A true Jewish food ethic is one that remembers the Garden of Eden.
It's like there's a side to that Ashkenormative that, you know, the experience, the shtetl experience and even the experience out in the Pale in Russia. Well, there's a certain, with the Jews adapted, you know, there's something to be said for that. You know, they were resilient using whatever means they had to adapt, using whatever was available. But essentially, like what you're saying is that it was only supposed to be not a means to an end, but it was a way to get by but somehow we lost that mm-hmm. and the process of getting back to that is somehow being seen. And I mean, you have an uphill battle, it sounds like, at Jewish Fed, right? To actually get that message across, because it's become so established. Do you see, the food traditions, not just in the holidays, but you're starting to talk about there's a nice dichotomy between the Ashkenazic and the Sephardic tradition. Mm-hmm. Do you have a tougher battle on the Ashkenazic side than you do on the Sephardic side?
Well, on the Sephardic side, it was a very different story in terms of what happened to diaspora. And it's, you know, and Sephardic being kind of Spain, Portugal, North Africa. There are Jewish communities, like, for instance, the B'nai Israel in India. There are Jews, like, in Nigeria. There are Jews all over the world. We went everywhere. So I'm speaking very specifically about my own background as Ashkenazic, and the Sephardic tradition I know more about. But in these other lands where Jews went to, it wasn't necessarily the same story of poverty and of, you know, being enclosed in ghettos. In a lot of cases, Jews actually thrived. And in those areas, you do see a lot more plant-based foods because that was available and because those fresh foods were there and because people had the means to use and prepare them. And so one of the things that's sad about the fact that we've ended up with this gefilte fish Judaism is that there are beautiful and abundant and rich and meaningful foods from other traditions that we completely ignore. And that's a sadness. That's something we've lost.
I hear you, and it's hats off to the mission of your organization to, you know, to get back to our roots. All right, I have a few minutes. I want to get it into a sort of follow up with. It's been almost a year since we talked, and the big mission we were working on last year was, of course, the Kapparos, which is the tradition for the second part of high holidays here, which is a Yom Kippur. For those who may not have been with us last year, why don't you tell us a little bit what Kapparos is, what the mission was last year, and here in the time of COVID, how we're making out with this. Give us an update.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Kapparos is a ritual that's performed by some of our fellow Jews, and it happens where Jewish Veg went was the streets of Brooklyn. It happens in a few other areas as well. Los Angeles has a little bit of Kapparos tradition. There are a few other places, but the main place that it happens in the United States that we have focused on at least last year was New York City and the streets of Brooklyn. And what happens is this ritual involves the use of chickens. These are 6-week-old baby chickens that practitioners will hold by the wings, swing around their heads while saying a few prayers, and then give to a shochet, a slaughterer, to be slaughtered. Mm-hmm. And as we're talking about, you know, returning to traditions and how traditions have changed, this is a custom. It is not something that you find anywhere like in the Torah, in the Talmud. This is something that developed as a folk practice somewhere around the 6th century CE. And at the time, even, it was contested. There were a lot of people like Nachmanides, the Ramban, who weren't fans of it. But it eventually kind of took hold in these certain Ashkenazic communities. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, it didn't actually start with chickens. It started first with young plants, and then kind of transformed into being about chickens. And that's a story, but basically it ended up being about chickens. But there was always this understanding that instead of using a chicken, you could use money, you could use coins. And so basically the purchase price of a chicken, you could use that money instead and perform the ritual with that. So what we did last year was we went to the streets of Brooklyn along with the Alliance to End Chickens as Kapparos and the SAVE movement. And we at Jewish Veg performed outreach as Jewish members of a community and speaking to practitioners and asking them, would you consider using coins instead of chickens in this ritual for the reasons of Tsar Bale Chaim, which is a Jewish law, which means to prevent the suffering of animals, and also for things like public health. And in the time of COVID-19, that's clearly a big concern. These animals are being slaughtered in the streets. It's very, very dangerous. And so what we felt our goal was and our mission was to create a conversation. And I'm happy to say that I think we really did that last year. And we had really deep, meaningful conversations with our fellow Jews and were able to talk about what it means to live out the value of Tsar Bale Chaim, of protecting animals, of showing compassion, and seeing how people respond to that and how it can change. And we had people say, you know, yes, I will use coins next year.
You know, it's funny, I hadn't thought of it until you just said it, but the from last year to this year, the image of what was going on, of what had traditionally gone on during that practice, it must look and feel and smell and sound like a wet market. Isn't it almost like this, you know, now there's such an outcry because we have a public awareness of what a wet market is. And, you know, for all seems that that's where COVID came from, you know, or certainly that's one of the primary culprits. And I know you haven't been able to do outreach this year because of COVID, but right. Does that put a different, put it in a different light?
In some ways, yes. I think it makes it even more urgent and more, you know, more important for people to be paying attention to this issue. I will say there is a public campaign that's happening, not Jewish Veg is not part of it, to draw attention to exactly that and to the fact that this does present a real public health risk. Jewish Veg does not take part in that. What we really see our role as is to have these conversations and to really connect with people. It's why we're not doing outreach this year, because the additional protection that we would need in order to be safe on the streets would make it really kind of impossible to have those same in-depth conversations. But what we're doing instead is we're trying to get the Jewish community to pay attention. And I think it's important for a number of reasons. For one, Kaporos, like we've been saying, is dangerous and also results in a lot of suffering and pain to animals. And as Jews, we're obligated to do something about that. But also, it makes us think about how we treat animals in the Jewish community as a whole. And this is kind of one example of ways in which the Jewish community is not living up to the value of Tsar Balei Chaim. And maybe the Jewish community as a whole, as a wider community, needs to see that in order to see the ways in which we don't live up to it in other ways.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense of, is it going on this year? I mean, I know you're not able to do mm-hmm. outreach this year. What's your sense, or at least from not, you know, from a remote, have they adjusted? Is it still going on the way it used to go on? And you know, COVID be damned, or how are they doing it?
We don't really know yet. So don't typically, we know that.
Oh, it's too early. Yeah,
most
yeah,
likely it's yeah. going to happen. Mm-hmm. We would all be shocked if it doesn't happen at all. Mm-hmm. But we don't know how many chickens. We don't know exactly where the sites are. We don't know any of that until the week of, partly because they know that we will be coming, that activists will be coming. And so they don't want us there. But we don't know yet. We expect and hope that it might be smaller this year, but we can't say for sure.
Okay. All right. Hey, we're out of time. So where can people go if they want to get more information on Jewish Veg or any of your programs or any of the good work that you are doing?
Go to jewishveg.org. That's jewishveg.org. Thank you, Laurent, for having me again.
My pleasure.
I hope to be back on very soon.
I do too. All right, that's Sarah Eifler, Jewish Veg Program Director. All right, what exactly is Trump veganism? Well, when we return, we'll have the second half of my conversation with Corey Renan. She's going to enlighten us. We'll be right back.
100 years ago, there were 100,000 tigers in the wild. Today, there are as few as 3,200. The Earth's wild animals can't speak up when they need help, but we can. Be the voice for those who have no voice. Visit worldwildlife.org.
I thought the major was a leader. So for a
Sir Paul McCartney. I can't believe we haven't featured any of his songs yet. He's a great friend of animals, as you probably know. And, you know, Jet is supposed to be about his black Labrador puppy. But I thought the suffragette reference was fitting for the second part of my conversation with Dr. Corey Wren, who, as you may recall, is the founder of the Vegan Feminist Network. You see what I did there? She's also a lecturer of sociology with the School of Social Policy, Sociology, and Social Research at the University of Kent, and co-director of the Center for the Study of Social and Political Movements. She's the author of A Rational Approach to Animal Rights, Extensions in Abolitionist Theory, and Piecemeal Protest, Animal Rights in the Age of Nonprofits. Last week we talked about what happens when a movement goes pro and the consequences of bureaucratization in animal rights. Today we'll dig a little deeper into that, looking at specific organizations, including a few we've had here on the show. And we're going to wrap up with Corey's intriguing concept of Trump veganism. Let me play a little game with you if you can. I kind of want to do this. So how about the United Poultry Concerns?
That's an interesting one. What do you think?
I would say abolitionist.
I would not have in the past said that, but I think that Karen Davis has definitely come around. The turning point for me was, I think, in 2013 or so. FARM, remember we mentioned them earlier about the contentious annual conference. Well, once again, this kind of abolitionist debate had started to bubble up at the, you know, the turn of the 2000s. It really kind of became a thing again, and or the 2010s rather. And so they had been petitioning to get some abolitionist speakers, and Farm historically has prohibited anyone from speaking at this event if they are in any way critical of the movement or critical of the big organizations. Ah. Now, not surprisingly, these big organizations are the primary donors for this conference. The conference is one of the major funding sources for Farm. So there's a major conflict of interest. So basically, Farm was shutting down radical discourse. Well, the whole point of a conference is to share ideas and give platform to new critiques and things like that. So it was problematic in a lot of ways. But what was really creepy, creepy, was that in protest, the abolitionists who had wanted to speak, Karen Davis being included in that, said, all right, well, if you're not going to let us play, we'll have our own mini conference in the same hotel. So they had organized this. And then the hotel, under pressure from Farm, had to kind of withdraw and say, you're not allowed to do that here anymore. So I think in the end, they had an impromptu meeting in someone's hotel room.
When was this? What year was this?
I think it was 2013 or so.
There before, okay.
Were you there?
I went in 2015 was the first year I went. Uh-huh. And I could, Karen Davis was, I'm almost positive, I have to double check, but I'm pretty sure I don't know if she was one of the speakers, but I know they had a, you know, booth. So that's kind of, so whatever happened back then, there was some sort of.
Yeah. And she was part of that pushback. And then I saw just today, she's got a new conference coming out on the Humane Hoax. I mean, that's classic abolitionist.
Yes.
Stuff right there.
And I had them on as well. And I would say they're out. Let me do another one with you.
Wait, before we move on, I just want to highlight UPC is small. UPC is a very small organization. So
yeah, that's kind of what I was getting. I'm going to hit you with another one here. You may not even, do you know Action for Animals, AFA?
Action for Animals. Is this in Australia?
Cool. No, Eric Mills, he's out on the west coast of the U.S. Rodeo, just almost 100% focused on rodeo. Very similar in structure and tone to people that I spoke with here on the show, to Steve Hindy at CHARC, in that the organization has remained small. He's remained very focused on almost a single topic on rodeo.
Yeah, this is where it would get muddy. That would get muddy. So for someone like me, who's kind of pretty strict on my definitions of abolition, I would be a little like, yeah, I don't know. I mean, he's focusing on one thing and yeah, but you know, technically he's trying to abolish this particular form of speciesism. Uh-huh. But, you know, once again, when you keep single issue like that, you don't necessarily need to sell out so much because you're focusing all your energy and resources on one specific thing in one specific region, it seems like. But I don't know enough to really comment.
Okay, that's cool. All right, so here's a bigger one now. This one might be Mercy for Animals.
Oh, geez. Okay. Welfarist.
Really?
Yeah. Well, okay. This one's been around for a while. This one was not in my survey, by the way, for my book, so... This is just based on, I know I've been watching them for many years, and they will also support welfarist bills and things like that. But I think that more recently, they're now using the V word, the vegan word, so maybe they're starting to come around.
You know, it's funny, as you say that, I can't think of all these, no matter where, now obviously, Humane Society and Humane League, welfare, and I think there's no question about that. But even from there all the way down to all of them, every single one of these, there's more I could go to, White Coat Waste Project and Non-Human Rights Project. They would all, everybody I spoke with, and by the way, I have a premise for my show is that I never, ever, and I will never ask a guest, are you vegan? I just don't, I won't do that because I have this thing with you talk about pigeonhole. The self-definition a vegan is, you know, it's too easy to fall off the wagon. If you fall off the wagon, are you no longer vegan? Is there a vegan police? So I don't want to do that to a guest. Yet, when I speak to these leaders and these organizations without fail, and I almost want to go back and double check, they always volunteer it. They volunteer.
Like I said, they started, all these folks started off radical, and they probably in their heart are still radical, but now they are professionals. Now they represent an organization, right? So your personal radical beliefs are now separate from you've become a mouthpiece for a professional organization. So, I mean, it's like when I teach animal rights at the University of Kent, I can't get up there and start spouting off about my abolitionist beliefs and radical veganism. That's my personal politics. So I have to be, you know, I represent the University of Kent. I'm representing the sociology department. So I have to give a much more muted, balanced sort of a lecture to them, you know?
Okay. All right. You know what? So that actually makes that talk makes a really neat segue here to the second thing that I wanted to talk with you about. If speaking about veganism, even in an academic setting, is you have to temper it. You just said it. you have to watch it. You can't be out there espousing, you know, this radical concept of veganism. You radical you. Then, as it's playing out in American politics right now, right on the ground, you've written about this thing called Trump veganism. Now, you wrote this article just about a year after the election. But I wanted to ask you about in the last week or so, Vice President Pence, shortly after the announcement of Kamala Harris as Joe Biden's running mate, made this little speech trying to, we're going to say pigeonhole, where we like that word today, pigeonholing Kamala Harris because she at some point was espousing reduction of meat eating. And Pence went all in after her, that this was a crazy radical thing to do, and that we Americans, we're not going to let anyone tell us that we can't have our meat.
Joe Biden and Kamala Harris would bury the economy under an avalanche of red tape, more regulation and more bureaucracy. In fact, the California senator that he named as his running mate this week said during her short campaign for president that Americans needed to be, and I quote, educated about the effect of our eating habits on our environment. Senator Kamala Harris said she would change the dietary guidelines of this country to reduce the amount of red meat Americans can eat. Well, I've got some red meat for you. We're not going to let Joe Biden and Kamala Harris cut America's meat.
It was the first time I'd seen this issue become politicized at that level, at the presidential level. We've had a candidate, Cory Booker, who is a vegan, using the word. We've had Julian Castro, one of the candidates, had talked about an animal platform, but we had never had an actual presidential, vice presidential moment like that, where he went right after, say, you know, that people who are attempting to talk about meat reduction is crazy, is radical. Now, can you talk about how that fits in, sort of back into it with what you call Trump veganism? Because that is a really cool concept.
Well, that's not exactly what the paper was about. And I will say, if anyone's interested in these connections, there's a guy named Christopher Sebastian, who is he's got some amazing lectures up on YouTube and on his website about this very topic. And he's done a lot of research into it. So is Carol Adams, of course, is kind of her main area. But my paper was born of something different because my main area of interest is factionalism and the animal rights movement, and I also do vegan feminist stuff. Well, one of the other, there's really, I identify in my book four major factions outside of the moderate mainstream group, and that's, you know, direct action, abolitionist, the no-kill folks, and then also the feminists. So the feminists kind of emerged as a faction in the 1980s, but started to really see a resurgence after the 2010s. And in response to that, because it started to get traction, right? It's riding the wave, the third wave of feminism. So it's starting to get traction in vegan spaces, animal rights spaces. And so inevitably you get the pushback. So one of the things that was really, really shocking was a manifesto created by 269 Life, which is a direct action group from Israel. And it was basically saying, non-humans first. We don't really care about what happens to humans. Humans are the oppressor. Human issues can be dealt with later. And, you know, it was coming at a time where it's quite offensive. Like, this is a moment where the third wave of feminism is coming up. Mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter is coming up. And this kind of stuff is just is offensive. But I'm watching this, and I'm keeping an eye on the animal rights space because I'm writing this book, and, you know, what's the pushback and all that. And I'm just, I was shocked that there was getting a lot of traction, these types of manifestos and these perspectives. And I also, full disclosure, I had founded Vegan Feminist Network because I was getting so much pushback and so many negative comments. At the time, I was really active in the abolitionist movement, and abolitionists who claim to be all about nonviolence would say all kinds of nasty stuff about women and people of color and all that kind of stuff. So I said, all right, something's going on here. And the rise of Trump in the United States was also something really, really, actually, I can say it. It was traumatic for me when Donald Trump rose to power and became president. I just could not believe this was happening. And a lot of my colleagues and just Americans in general, like, we had the largest protest in American history in response to this shock, this national shock. So the paper really is about, like, how is this emerging in our own movement, our supposed social justice movement, this kind of bizarre support.
There's an argument you sort of as the basis of that the vegan movement historically has been, and to some extent you're saying still is, white dominated and predominantly middle class, and that sort of feeds into, I guess, what we call the Trump vegans. Do you see that? Do you see that as still the case, that even in the live in the aftermath, or as we're living, you know, with Black Lives Matter, and I did have a couple guests on to talk about that as well. Is animal rights, animal abolition, whatever you want to call it, the movement as whole, are we still in this middle class sort of comfortable? Is that who's driving this?
After doing that research, and by the way, that research entailed a survey of 300 American vegans, and I will admit there's a slight bias to it because I used several channels to recruit people to respond to that survey, but a couple of them were through my social media, so it may have been people who were already geared toward that. But what I'm starting to come to realize is a lot of this negative stereotyping of vegans as being very selfish and not caring about what happens to other humans. That's a lot of that's coming from the counter movement. But when I started to see it from vegans myself, creating things like that 269 life manifesto, it was frightening stuff. But in the survey, I found about 1 in 10 people had voted for Trump and kind of supported Trump sort of beliefs or conservative beliefs. So that was there, but still the vast majority of people were not into that. And then also, more importantly, these activists, I was also asking that, what other movements do you support? What other movements are you active in? And the vast majority of folks were very active in other social movements. So there we go. We have a survey and we can see that actually these people are quite intersectionally minded.
Mm-hmm. What other movements are there?
Black Lives Matter, or environmental movement was a big one. I think that one was top of the list. The feminist movement. There's a whole litany of movements.
Okay, it's actually that's a whole nother thing, the environmental versus the animal rights. That is a really intriguing split. I wonder if you've ever done any work on that. We've had a couple shows on that where those two movements are not aligned. They're getting there, but they have traditionally been almost opposed, which is I found initially very surprising.
It's weird. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. Actually, well, the what was behind it is, of all things, was the role of one of the factors, the role of science, and that science has traditionally not been a friend of the animal rights movement. If you think about vivisection and animal research, where it has definitely been a friend of the environmental movement in terms of the research that's done there from the macro versus the micro level. So all that played in. It was a really, really fascinating study. Another aspect of the Trump veganism is which really plays into right now is this notion of law and order. And I think your quote was, activists who disrupt privilege mechanisms, with identity politics, are subject to Trumpian law and order efforts to diminish the relevance and visibility of the other. I think that's a really great quote. I was wondering if you could unpack that a little bit for us.
So I can give an example of this. So like I said, the abolitionist faction was surprisingly, I mean, I should give a shout out to the moderates. You know, part of the thing about, you know, becoming professional is they started to adopt this diversity rhetoric and, you know, all that sort of stuff. It actually looks good for them and it helps them to reach more donors and it's great for their grant applications. So you're starting to see that the feminist faction is having an impact on the mainstream organizations. But the more radical organizations, the radical factions, that's where a lot of this debate is happening. So the abolitionist movement, although it's one of the premises is it should be about abolishing violence and, you know, nonviolence all the way, tended to be quite hostile in a lot of ways to the rise of feminist voices, voices of color, things like that. So I will give an example of, say, AFCO and Breeze Harper, who are two of the biggest forces for introducing critical race theory to the animal rights movement. And they received so much pushback and so much shouting down. And I can also say as myself, just as a white woman running Vegan Feminist Network, people would slam me all the time to where I actually had to do a major social media break. And to this day, do not even use my real name on Facebook because I was harassed so badly by the abolitionists and just anti-feminists in general. And it's not enough that they disagree. The whole point is that they want to shut you down. They do public shaming. So Breeze Harper and AFCO were really, really slammed on some of the leading abolitionist spaces, like Gary Francione's Facebook page. He really took them to town. So there was this, it was a public shaming, like this is a space where you don't belong sort of thing. You know, this is our country, our territory. And if you don't like it, get out. I mean, it's classic Trump politics.
Yeah, and that, amazing. That, you know, and it is classic. That's we're living it right now. You know, we're seeing it. We're seeing it right in, you know, as we get closer and closer to the election. It's exactly that. Hey, listen, Corey, we're getting close to time here. This has been really great. We need to keep going with this at some point. But where can people go to tell us, see some of your writing, some of your work, through research, or some of the organizations. We didn't even get to talk about this organization, I think is really intriguing, which is the International Association of Vegan Sociologists. I know you're just getting that off the ground here. I love that. I think that is, because if you talk about the whole concept of a movement, you know, sociology is where that's going to happen, you know, where we're going to really look at that and understand that from a movement perspective, as opposed to individuals responding to something. But anyway, tell us where people can go and get more information, any of these organizations, any of your publications, anything you like.
I would say go to my website, coreyleewrin.com, and you can sign up for my newsletter there. I send one out every 4 months or so. Almost everything I've ever published is up on my website. I also make an effort to write easier to digest blog posts about more academic stuff. So if you don't want to trudge through a 30-page journal article, you can just check out the blog. If you want more fun stuff, you can check me out on Instagram. You can see me eating vegan food, drinking in British pubs, and my new dog, and all that good stuff. And I'm also on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and academia.edu, all that stuff.
Awesome.
Thanks for having me. This has been really,
it's been
really
great. Yeah, I really, really appreciate it. We're definitely going to, we have to continue. It's just, there's so much that you offer that we didn't even get to. But definitely thank you for your time. And we will, best of luck, and we'll definitely stay in touch. When we return, Dr. Tom Picard takes us through why our dogs and cats are itching so much this time of year and what to do about it. Don't go away.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
We think our vet is very helpful. We think our vet is smart and nice. Our vet takes such good care of us, but would rather stay home, would rather be home to catch mice.
And we're back on The Other Animals here on WWDB, joined now by Dr. Tom Picard of All Pets House Calls. Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Hello, Lawrence. How are you?
Oh, just another day. All right, so we've got an interesting topic for us today. So we want to talk about why is my dog and cat scratching. And of course, the first thing you think about when you bring that subject up is, well, the only thing, the reason my dog and cat could be scratching is because they've got fleas. But I have a hunch you're going to tell us it's not quite that simple.
It is not quite that simple. You are right.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, this time of year particular, in the fall, depending on where you live, at least in the Northeast here, definitely one of the factors are fleas. They generally breed all through the spring and summer, and they'll, you know, they'll bother your pets during the spring and summer, as everyone knows. Mm-hmm. But what most people don't know is that the height of flea season in this area of the country is really November, maybe even into December.
Really?
And it's based on the, they've had all summer to breed. We generally, you know, have falls that are pretty nice. And it's not until we get the first couple of good solid frosts, you know, below freezing every night for a few nights that they start to dwindle in numbers outside. So anymore, that can be the end of November, maybe even into December.
And so since they've been, they've had this nice, they've been breeding very comfortably, is what I'm hearing. And now it starts to get cold, and now they're looking for a nice warm body to continue their existence on. That's where the dogs
are. Yeah, well, I mean, they've been finding those warm bodies all summer as well. Yeah. And they come into our houses, but now they're really going to be looking for that. They go into abandoned houses, your house, everything. They come in on your dogs if they're outside, cats, they'll come in on people. I have people who have fleas and their pet has fleas. They've never left a high rise of their apartment building. They clearly hitchhike in on people looking for a meal inside.
And it's not
so
just
they're awesome.
And it's not just their skin. I mean, they'll go on people's clothing too, right?
Absolutely. That's how they hitchhike. So that is a major reason for it. And the easiest way to do it is to look through your pet's fur. Use a flea comb, preferably. If you comb through often enough, like around the base of their tail, on their stomach area, things like that, those are the common areas, you'll find them. You'll look in your comb as you pull the kind of hair out that you've been brushing out, and you see these little brown things like jumping or struggling and trying to run. You got them.
It's indiscriminate, right? They're dogs and cats, they're equal opportunity tormentors, right?
Absolutely. They love us too. But we have less fur, but they love us as well. So, and the biting, if you're not sure, take a mosquito and magnify multiply the biting itch times about 100, then you'll know. It's way worse than mosquitoes generally.
Okay.
But another big time of year for this is allergies are big this time of year and other times of year, of course, too. But this is ragweed season coming up. That's a biggie. Other plants are starting to dry up, and dogs and cats and people are allergic to all these same things. The difference is our eyes and nose and throats are what itch generally, and we sneeze. Dogs and cats, their skin itches, so they get ear rashes, skin rashes, anywhere on their body. It's often one ear. Why not the other ear? We don't know. But it can be both ears, of course, but it's often one. Weirdly enough, we don't know why.
Why?
They just get rashes.
And they'll scratch that thing bloody, I'm guessing, right? And
absolutely. They'll scratch their ear practically off their head sometimes. They're, ripping their head up. I had one this week that had such divots in its own head. It was a cat from using its own claws, which of course in cats are vicious, but it was using them on itself. But cats are good healers. They got him on some medication for it, and he's looking better already. Dogs too.
We could tie these two together. Tell me, you reminded me way back in the day, I had a cat that we put she had an allergic reaction to a flea collar, and we figured out what was going on. We removed the flea collar, but she'd started to make a cut, a lesion on the where it had been, and each time we would try to heal over to get a scab, she'd cut it open. The itching was so terrible. Is that now? I know we're not using flea collars as much today anymore, but we sort of those two things could sometimes be related, right? In other words, can dogs and cats have reactions to?
Oh, absolutely, reactions to anything. It could be In the wintertime, we see it still too, because people close up their windows, of course, and then house dust and house molds and fibers from carpets and things get all stirred up, and people will be allergic to that too, but certainly dogs and cats have a lot of those allergies as well. And it generally looks the same. You think you have fleas, and they might, but if in the absence of fleas, it's almost always some sort of airborne allergen is getting them. It's almost always that.
And so if a pet owner sees that symptom where they're scratching, I mean, if they've eliminated the fleas, because the first thing you think about, I would think, is what you just said, go after it with the comb. They're not pulling anything off. So then the next thing to conclude is that it is some sort of an allergic reaction. Do you give your dogs and cats, you know, Benadryl? Or
definitely before you can get to your vet, one of the safest things you can give is Benadryl. Generally, it's pretty safe because often it doesn't work. It doesn't do that much. Oh, but wow. Sometimes it does.
Same dosage? In other words, the human dosage?
No, they take tons more than we do. Like, you know, we might take as an adult human 25 milligrams every, uh-huh, you know, 6 to 8 hours. And that sometimes is barely enough for a cat. And yet, you know, you don't want to give them so much because you reach a dose where they get really drowsy, which is not so bad because then they're not itching so much. But generally speaking, there's lots of medications out there that are much safer than steroids, corticosteroids. But we know that corticosteroids, especially for the severe ones that are ripping themselves apart, we'll give them an injection of that, dexamethasone, prednisolone tablets, whatever, just to make them stop before they, you know, need to be hospitalized just for the wounds they cause on themselves with their teeth and their claws. But then later there's things like, there's new medications out. I've been using a lot of this one called Apoquel, and it's not for cats, there's ones they're developing more for cats. And it really seems to work pretty well in a lot of dogs. It's like human allergy medicine, you know, one pill twice a day for like 2 weeks, and maybe you're good to go for a while. Maybe you need to be on it longer. It just depends on the severity.
And it's doing essentially the same. They're effectively antihistamines. They're reducing or eliminating the overreaction, if I'm understanding my own understanding.
Pretty much.
Allergy. Yeah.
Pretty much the same idea, yes.
And
there's different classes of drugs. They're not all antihistamines, but that's the general idea, is to reduce the body reaction.
Would there be, I'd be tempted as a pet owner that if I saw my pet itching like that, in addition, or maybe before I got to the medicine, to the pills or whatever, anything you can rub on the skin to soothe some of the itching? Is there any topical,
I generally find it doesn't work all that well because you practically would need to dip their body in a bath of stuff, you know, and it would be like, you know, cortisone cream or something like that, which they'll tend to lick off, which, you know, sometimes makes them a little sick, might not, but it just doesn't work super well. It's different for us where we have bare skin too, and you have a little bug bite and you dab a little cortisone cream just on that bite and, you know, it helps a lot until you maybe need something else. But them, they're having full body itching sometimes where it's head to toe, different spots are itching. It's just almost impractical to put a topical on. One little spot like a human sometimes, but that often isn't the case. And you can't goop up the whole inside of their ear with cortisone.
Yeah, there's that.
And it just doesn't work as well. The medicines that they take by mouth or injections from us just seem to be a lot more practical and a lot more effective.
So that's all the time we have today. I want to thank my guests, Sarah Eifler and Corey Wren. And as always, I want to love to hear from you with your comments, ideas, or suggestions, or if there's a topic you'd like Dr. Picard to address, just check out theotheranimals.com and let us know. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter at theotheranimals and Facebook as well. Same handle. Don't forget to check out our partner podcasters at iroarpod.com. Next week, are they donkeys, mules, or burros? Well, in medieval Europe, they were asses. And it's just fun to say that. You don't want to miss our conversation with Catherine Smithies, who just published the definitive book on medieval asses. Until then, find a belly to rub, stay safe, everyone, and have a happy new year, and safe as well. We'll see you next week.